more egalitarians, Thomas Nagel and Ronald Dworkin. Now, probably those of you whose reading is just mainly on libertarianism won't be familiar with these people, but they're extremely well regarded in wait, let me just readjust my chair here. I don't like the angle here. Ah, that's a bit better. Okay, so these are extremely important philosophers. Thomas Nagel is, in my opinion, probably one of the best philosophers in the United States or in the world. He's not, his views on social philosophy are very much not in agreement with libertarianism, but he's nevertheless a very deep thinker. And Ronald Dworkin is probably the leading American legal philosophers. And both of these are egalitarians, that's to say, people who think that there's one of the aims in the theory of justice is should be to stress equality. We'll see to what extent they stress it, and Dworkin especially stresses it to an extreme degree, as we'll see. He regards it as a supreme value in the theory of justice. Now, I want to start off with mentioning the problem that came up in Rawls's theory. Remember the last time we were talking about Rawls's difference principle. Remember, the difference principle says that all inequalities in society have to be to the advantage of a least well-off group. So it's all right to have inequality, but it has to be to advantage a least well-off group. Otherwise, we would have to have equality. We can't have inequalities that are just, say, because they're what results from your use of your own property. The inequalities have to be justified in some way by being for the benefit of a least well-off class. Remember, one of the reasons Rawls thinks that, one reason he thinks that inequality has to be justified by helping the least well-off is that he thinks that those with superior talents don't deserve to benefit from it. So if somebody said to Rawls, well, look, I'm very good, say, I'm a very good basketball player, of course, I'm personally not, we're just imagining somebody saying it. Somebody says, I'm a very good basketball player, so if people want to pay me some kind of enormous salary, why shouldn't I be able to get that? Why does what I get depend on helping out the least well-off class? Now, Rawls would reply to that. Remember, we went over this last time. Part of his reply would be, well, the reason I have the superior basketball ability is I happen to be born with a lot of talent, or maybe my parents were took me out and played basketball when I was very young with me, and I built up certain skills that happened to be of great value because a lot of people like basketball. So I don't really deserve to benefit from these superior talents. So I shouldn't really complain if I have to just get whatever inequality would help out the least well-off class. I can't complain. I can't say, well, why shouldn't I be able to benefit to the fullest extent possible from my superior talents? Rawls wouldn't allow that because people don't deserve to benefit from their superior talents. These are due to luck. Now, this view raises a severe problem for Rawls's theory or any other theory that is saying that people's superior talents stem from luck, so they don't deserve to have them. Rawls doesn't think that rich countries have a duty to send money to poor countries in accord with the difference principle. So this difference principle operates only within a particular society. That, say, in the United States, we have to help those who are the least well-off group in our society. All the inequalities have to be for their benefit, not so we can't have inequality that's not to the advantage of the least well-off. But we don't have a duty to, say, help the poor in Bangladesh to the same extent. We don't have to say all the inequalities that we have to be for the benefit of a least well-off class in Bangladesh or somewhere else. It's just confined within each society. But one could raise an objection to Rawls. Isn't a matter of luck that people are born in a rich country like the United States? So how can he justify saying that we just have to help the least well-off class in our own society? Why is it that one doesn't have to extend this difference principle to worldwide, so cover the poor all over the world? And you can see why people would be reluctant to do that, because considering there's some extremely poor people in the world, you'd probably get a great deal of redistribution, and we, those of us who are fortunately living in the United States, we'd have to give up a large part of our living standard if this difference principle were applied worldwide. So this considerably reduces the attractiveness of this kind of theory to people. If you just said, well, okay, we do have such a duty, and there's some stalwarts who want to go ahead and say, okay, that's fine. Not very many people are going to go along with it. You don't have to be a libertarian to say, well, I don't think that's such a good idea. I'm not going to support this kind of moral theory. So the people who are egalitarian to want to have a theory that will appeal to most people had some way of blocking this kind of application of equality worldwide. They don't want to be universalist, in part because this would be a very difficult theory to accept. We might want to say, if that's what morality requires, it's just too demanding. Remember, Rawls speaks of what he calls the strains of commitment. We don't want to have a theory that's so difficult that people won't be able to live up to it. Suppose you said, well, it's just our duty to sacrifice ourselves for the poor in India or Africa, Bangladesh. Probably people won't be able to accept it, even if there's some argument that says it's the right thing to do. Of course, I don't think there is, but I'm just doing this from the point of view of the egalitarian. Wouldn't we, what would happen if they want to say, you should give aid to all these people all over the world? People just wouldn't want to do it. So problem that egalitarians like Nagel and Dworkin have, they want to try to say, how can you confine redistribution, egalitarian redistribution, just to one society, given the general argument that luck, if you say, well, people don't deserve to benefit because their superior talents stem from luck, then isn't it also luck that we're born in a rich society? So why doesn't the redistribution apply then? Now, I want to turn now to Thomas Nagel. I'll just tell you a little bit. He's a, I don't know Dworkin, but I do know Nagel a little bit. I sent an exchange email. I'll tell you a story about him. I may have told this one before. I think it's a funny story. In the early 1980s, Bob Nozick got into bit of trouble with many libertarians because he was renting an apartment from Eric Siegel, the one who wrote Love Story in Cambridge, Massachusetts, And it turned out the apartment was supposed to be under rent control. And he was paying a higher rent than that. He didn't know that it was supposed to be under rent control. And when he found out about it, he sued for all the back rent. He sued Eric Siegel for all the back rent. And he collected about, I think, about $20,000 in the settlement. So Siegel was a friend of the editor of the New Republic, Marty Peretz, and Peretz had an article published by a man called Turner attacking Nozick for being hypocritical. He was supposed to be a libertarian, but here he is taking advantage of a rent control law. So I remember Nagel said to me when this happened, he read the story, he said, "I don't get it. What's the inconsistency?" So I guess he wasn't that familiar with libertarianism, but he did say that. Now, to get a grasp of what Nagel thinks about equality, we have to realize, we say, well, why does he favor equality? He thinks that practically everybody favors equality. It's not just that he favored it, but everybody favored equality, at least under some interpretation. So when he says it, he doesn't mean to be saying anything very controversial. He isn't saying, well, everybody is a luck egalitarian like Rawls. Everybody thinks that income should be equally distributed unless it's an advantage of really slow off. But he thinks there's some kind of innocuous sense in which everybody favors equality. So this view that he thinks everybody favors equality, it applies to utilitarian moral theories and rights-based theories like libertarianism, as well as to egalitarian ones. That seems like a surprising contention, but nevertheless, that's what he wants to say, that all these different moral theories, utilitarian and the rights-based ones, are, as well as the straight egalitarian ones, are, in a sense, theories that favor equality. Now, we have the question, well, why should we want to favor equality in some sense? This is a very famous view of his, find in the book, it's called The World from Nowhere. He says we can consider our lives from two different points of view. There's from the personal standpoint, that's to say the way we're just living our own lives, we care about ourselves and people we're close to, like each of us cares about, say, yourself, and of course your family, your friends, various other people, you know, and other people you wouldn't care that much about. Say, they're most of the billions of people in the world I don't even know, so I really don't care a tremendous amount about them. I might have some sympathy for them, there's just kind of general human sympathy, but from my own personal point of view, those people matter much less to me than myself or people who are close to me. So Nagel isn't saying that the wrong way to look at things, but this is the personal standpoint. We all look at our lives in this way. Now, here's one where it goes on from there to make a different point, where here he'll be in a lot of trouble with the objectivists. But he says it. He says there's another way we can look at our lives, not just the personal standpoint. We can look at our lives from what he calls the impersonal standpoint. And here, what we do is we step back from our lives. And we're stepping back from our lives and ourselves, and from just looking at things from this impersonal point of view. We're just sort of imagining that kind of you're looking at your own life, and you're just kind of watching yourself, and watching other people. So here we could say our life counts as no more important than anyone else's. There's nothing special about us. Like imagine, person from Mars looking at all these different people on the Earth, he wouldn't say he might have, might find some more interesting than others, but he wouldn't say that my particular life is somehow better than anybody else's just because it's mine. He would just look at the people and say, well, they're all important to themselves. Each person is leading his own life, and in some sense, no one is intrinsically more important than anyone else. It's just, just as I care very much about my own family, other people care about their families. There's nothing really special about my family from this kind of impersonal point of view. I can kind of stand back and look at the impersonal thing impersonally and see each person is really equally important from this impersonal standpoint. And I just see in my first sentence, I have a horrible mistake in grammar there. Does anyone spot what the mistake in grammar is in the first sentence of my slide? No, in the first sentence, we can step back from our lives and we ourselves from an impersonal standpoint. Well, of course, it should be step back from us and us ourselves. So we step back from us, it takes the object. I should be executed for that. But unless it does have the verb, it's governed by the verb step back. It's what we're stepping back from. We're stepping back from ourselves. So I think probably what I should have done, just eliminate the we altogether from the lives of ourselves. I should have just left that out. So, but you see what he means by this impersonal standpoint. It's a bit hard to grasp, but it's just saying, so when we're looking at our lives, if just considering ourselves among all the other people there are, we see there's nothing intrinsically important about ourselves as compared with other people. So from this impersonal standpoint, Nagel thinks, suppose I have a reason to avoid pain. I don't like pain. I try to avoid it. So I have to recognize, from this impersonal standpoint, the fact that someone else is in pain gives me a reason, other things being equal, to relieve his pain. So let's understand what Nagel is saying. It's sort of, when I say, I have a reason to avoid pain, Nagel thinks, I'm not just saying I personally don't like pain. Nagel thinks I'm saying there's an objective reason to avoid pain that applies to anybody. Pain, I see that pain is something we have a reason to avoid. So then if I help somebody else out who's in pain, I would have a reason to do that. Now, he doesn't think he's always an overriding reason, in most cases an overriding reason to, but he thinks that I couldn't say, well, pain is bad just for me. I would have to say pain is bad for everybody, looking at things in the internal, from this in-person standpoint. And if it's a reason for me to avoid pain, I have to recognize that I have a reason to relieve pain in others, but the reason just doesn't apply just to me. Well, Jock asked about masks. They would just be a special case. I think he's not considering them there. Now, you could see a possible objection here one could raise to what Nagel's saying. Somebody could say, well, maybe all I have to recognize is for each person, avoiding pain would be bad for him. But would I have to recognize that I have a reason to try to relieve pain to everybody else? Nagel would say, yes, you do. He thinks that from this impersonal standpoint, once you recognize that you think it's something is bad, like nothing special about me, so then this reason to avoid pain applies to everybody else as well. Now, you now want to see how equality, and this is why we've gone over from this impersonal standpoint, is that's why we should be concerned with equality at all, because we aren't just concerned just with our own life or just from a personal standpoint. We want to look at the impersonal standpoint. We have to view our lives from the impersonal standpoint as well, and here we're just one person among everybody else, and we're not better than other people. We're just one among other people from this impersonal standpoint. Now, when you consider utilitarianism, you might think that utilitarianism doesn't treat people as equal, because remember, the kind of utilitarianism we're considering here is one that says we just add up the utilities in various courses of action, and we just maximize the total. So it's not like the type of utilitarianism Mises and Henry Hazlitt have, where we just say free market helps human welfare, helps social cooperation. This is a different view. It's like we're trying to add up utilities. So you might say, well, this theory isn't treating people as equal, because it's saying just what's important is just adding up all the utilities. Now, wait, we have a question here from Leslie. It's an interesting question. Is Nagel jumping from an is to an ought here? Leslie, how do you think Nagel might be doing that? I'm not clear as to what your question is. But in the meantime, we have, why does Nagel think that even though utilitarianism just as added maximizing utility, then he still thinks that it, in a sense, can be called egalitarian theory. It's still counting people, it's still, in a sense, theory that has an element of equality. And he says because it counts everybody's utility the same. The question is, pain is bad for everybody. I see Leslie's question is, pain is bad for everybody. I would follow, I have to relieve everybody's pain. Well, what he's not claiming that it follows just from saying that pain is bad, but it's following from saying that it's a reason for me to relieve pain, to relieve my pain. He's thinking reasons aren't personal in that way. From this impersonal point of view, a reason applies to everyone who has pain. So I don't just have a personal reason to get rid of my pain. He's thinking there's an objective reason out there to relieve anybody's pain. So this is just what you get. It's not deducing it from the fact that people feel pain. He's just deducing it from his impersonal view, which he said, if you look at lives not from your own point of view, you'll find there are objective reasons to do certain things that don't just apply to particular people. And if it's a reason for me to relieve pain, then it's a reason for everybody else. And one possible way to get around that is that we say, well, there aren't objective reasons for anybody, so I don't have an objective reason to relieve my pain, or just have a personal reason to do so. That was what I was trying to mention earlier as a possible objection. Okay, so in utilitarianism, everybody's utility counts the same. So it isn't that some people say you count my utility twice as much as yours, but everybody's utility counts the same. So in that sense, it's an egalitarian theory, treats people as equal. However, Nagel thinks, and I think he's on good grounds here, it can be criticized because particular people can wind up sacrificing the general good. Remember the famous example I gave where the sheriff is going to execute an innocent person to avert a riot. So if it turns out that's the way to maximize utility, then this is at the expense of the innocent man, person who was killed. So you're sacrificing some to help others. And you could see something like, suppose somebody said, well, I think we should just go in and bomb a certain country, even if the people there suffer from it, because it'll benefit everybody else, and the total utility will go up. So see, this is really not, in a sense, it's not taking those people, not respecting the people who are sacrificed. But nevertheless, utilitarianism does have this aspect of equality in it, which counts for everybody's utility the same. Now, you might think that a theory that stresses rights, like libertarianism, isn't an egalitarian theory, because remember, in libertarianism, people are free to make it do with their property what they want, as long as you don't violate other people's rights. You can have vast inequalities of wealth and income. There's nothing wrong with that libertarian theory. But Nagel thinks this is also, yes, that's right, Jock is pointing out equal freedom. That was from Herbert Spencer. And so Nagel thinks that along these lines that Jock is suggesting, in a rights theory, saying everyone has the same rights, so in that sense, it also has an aspect of equality in it, in this theory. Now, one point I think Nagel is very good on, he recognizes that if you have a system of morality based on rights, like libertarianism, you have to take these rights to be negative. I say rights that forbid people from doing certain actions. In libertarian system, you have people can't initiate force against other people, can't aggress against other people. But if you try to have a system where people have positive rights, say everyone has the right to a secure income, then it might, this, if you have that theory, it might be that or free health care. People might not be able to all exercise their rights at the same time. What if there just wasn't enough to go around to give everybody free health care? So you wouldn't be able to observe all the rights consistently. So if you want to have a consistent rights-based theory, then Nagel thinks, I think he's right here, you would have to have one that is built on negative rights, like utilitarianism. Now, the approach he's sympathetic to, it's a third approach, it's neither utilitarian nor rights-based completely the way of libertarianism. He says there's another way we can take account of the equality of persons. Remember, we want to do that because we're talking about this impersonal point of view from which my life is no more intrinsically important than anybody else's. Even though each of us for each person, his or her own life is the most significant to him, the person will also recognize from the impersonal point of view, I'm just one among many others. So in this third way, this third approach, the way we respect the equality of persons is that we give preference to those who have the most urgent needs. So supposing we're considering how to distribute money, we would favor those who are worst off. It's very much like Rawls. If you say, well, the people with most urgent, we're respecting equality among people because we're saying their urgent needs are more important than, say, my less urgent needs. If we said, well, we should prefer, I don't care about their, let them answer if they have enough medical care. If this interferes with my vacation in Europe, I'd be saying, really, I'm more important than they are. So we would, on this view, give preference to people who have the most urgent needs. However, this preference isn't an absolute one. We think that we have some, remember, because we have this impersonal point of view. We also have a personal point of view from which our own lives are most important. And Nagel isn't saying we always judge things, we should always judge things from the impersonal point of view. He just says there are these two points of view, personal and impersonal, and they somehow have to be balanced against one another. And even if we're within the impersonal point of view, then we still have to count not just this distributive equality, we also have to count rights and overall consequences. So what Nagel wants to do is he says there's something in all these three different theories, utilitarian, rights-based theory, this direct egalitarian process, that we have to balance them against each other, plus balancing against the, these are in the impersonal point of view, we also have to consider how the impersonal point of view balances against the personal point of view. So see, things are a bit on the complicated side with Nagel. Now, you might think, given all this, Nagel is going to say that we have strong egalitarian duties to redistribute money to the poor, but he doesn't say this, and this I've already gone over, but he said, well, we might have some duty to help those who are really unfortunate. Maybe somebody's just out there lying in the street, we have some duty to help them, but we can't get comprehensive obligations out of it. Because remember, I mentioned this just previous line, the impersonal point of view isn't overriding, so it's not saying you just have to devote everything to helping the worst off. It's just that there's some, we have some duty to help those who have urgent needs, but it's not clear what that duty entails. So this doesn't seem like he's going to get, maybe can solve that problem I mentioned for Rawls, so we could say, well, we don't have strong duties to help poor in Bangladesh or Africa. We're not going to be able to get much of a theory of justice out of it. But as you would expect from Nagel, he has an answer to this. He says that people within a nation have stronger obligations to each other than to those outside the nation. So we're all citizens of the United States, so we're all kind of sharing in a common enterprise. So we have stronger duties toward other people, the people in the United States, than we would to those who aren't in our country. So there, I see M.R. Arlowski doesn't like this theory too much. And you can see those of you who study political philosophy will see this is very much like Rousseau's kind, Jean-Jacques Rousseau kind of the general will. We're sort of all in it together in the moral community. And Nagel thinks this moral community generates strong egalitarian obligations. Now, it would seem like, suppose Nagel says this, we're in this moral community, we have all these obligations to each other. And I see Jacques is saying, he says this because we cannot succeed. Well, Jacques, you're raising just the point I'm going to mention now, which is this is the obvious objection to right on target here. You might say, well, what if I don't want to be in part of this egalitarian moral community? Good, you got to see what I'm doing. So he says, what if I don't want to be in that? Can I just leave? Well, Nagel wouldn't say you have to be in it if you don't want to, but here's where the most controversial aspect of Nagel's theory comes in. If you didn't want to be part of the community, you couldn't take your property with you if you left, unless, of course, people like in the community like to do that. And the reason for this is, in Nagel's view, you don't have absolute property rights. All property is conventional. What he means by conventional is just decided on by a particular community. So it isn't, say, if in a libertarian system, say, we're self-owners and then we homestead property individual. Nagel said, no, that isn't the way things are. It's just there's a community that's there and they just dole out, they decide among each other, among one another, who's to get what property. It's just purely a matter of decision, or they couldn't just follow certain customs. So in this view, Nagel calls this a political conception of justice. We start with people in a nation who have land and resources at their disposition. So let's say all the people in the United States could be considered deciding what to do with the land and resources. So they don't have justice-based obligations to people in other nations. And the reason for this is that on this theory that Nagel is advocating, the property is just owned by, or at the disposition, probably owned is the best word, it's at the disposition of people just in that community. So Nagel calls this a political conception of justice rather than a cosmopolitan conception. A cosmopolitan conception of justice, rights and obligations aren't dependent on the political community. Say, libertarian view, which is would be an example of a cosmopolitan position, that would say, well, people have their self-owners and you acquire property by homesteading it. It doesn't matter from that theory whether you're a citizen of the United States or France or some country in Africa. You acquire property in the same way. So Nagel's theory is different. He says, no, it's you have all these different communities and you only have property rights as determined by people within that community. So there aren't natural rights to property. Now, as Nagel notes himself, the political conception of justice that he's favoring stems from Thomas Hobbes. Remember the great English political philosopher who lived from 1588 to 1679. So in Hobbes' theory, remember, people are surrendering all their arms to the sovereign. They're surrendering everything to the sovereign. And once they do that, it's up to him to distribute property as he wishes. People in the Hobbesian system don't have property rights that the sovereign is bound to respect. So similarly, in Nagel's theory, it's up to the people in the nation to decide on property rights. And in doing so, they'll take into account these egalitarian considerations that are based on their bonds in forming the community. Now, the obvious objection libertarianism will raise is that Nagel hasn't shown that property rights are conventional. He's saying, well, look, there aren't natural rights to property. Property is just something to be decided on by the community. And we want to know, well, what are his arguments against libertarian natural rights? And it turns out he really doesn't have any. And you might think, well, isn't that odd that he's a very distinguished philosopher? How could he just say that just ignore the view that people have natural property rights? And the reason for that is he thinks it's obvious, it's something that really, when you think of it, nobody can deny that property is conventional. And what we mean by conventional is just that property rights are just established by a particular society. So, in answer, let's see who said this. Jacques said, the only convention is one based on self-ownership. So, Nagel would say, he would have conventional wider sense, so it's really up to the people concerned to dole out the property in any way they want. And one reason he thinks is, why do you think it's conventional? Well, supposing you accept the libertarian theory of homesteading, which is the way you get it in Murray Rothbard or Thomas Hoffman, wouldn't we have to admit that a lot of the details or how all the details are worked out aren't something that we can just read off from the theory of what is the correct account of homesteading, what exactly you have to do to homestead property, how the particular kinds of property would be defined, wouldn't naval things, wouldn't even libertarians have to admit that when you fill in all the details, it turns out that everything is conventional. And you say, well, people who acquire property by homesteading, isn't homesteading conventional? But I think we can see there's a big problem with Nagel's argument. Suppose he's right, and I think he is, that we need all sorts of detailed regulations to establish property rights. This doesn't imply that people or the group can make whatever regulations they want. Say a libertarian, you would have to make these regulations, fill in the detail in accord with people's natural rights. We can compare this, suppose you just took, say, run a parallel argument to Nagel about free speech. Suppose you say, well, the right to free speech is entirely conventional because don't we need legal regulations to establish when we can speak? I say I've left the word out, but when we can speak. So say you have a park, you have to decide on what conditions can people speak in the park. You'd have to set up all sorts of detailed regulations on who speaks when. Like you'd say that people can speak in their own property. That would be the libertarians, and it's up for them to regulate who else is speaking. But what we would say, this doesn't show the fact that we need all these regulations, doesn't show that free speech is conventional, because the regulations have to conform to our natural right to free speech. So why couldn't the same thing be true for property rights? Nagel hasn't shown that property rights are conventional in the sense that people can assign these property rights and communicate whatever way they want. Now, we'll now turn, I devote most of the time to Nagel, but we still want to talk about Dworkin, who's another philosopher that we don't consider. He's also, as mentioned, extremely influential. And like Nagel, Dworkin's theory of justice is confined to a particular society. He doesn't really address the issue much of what obligations, if any, we have to people in other societies. So the key principle for him is that each person in a society should be treated with equal respect. So we all, it's kind of a Kantian view in the second form of categorical imperative, each person is an end in himself. So each person has to be treated with equal respect. Now, this doesn't imply, need not imply, that each person is treated exactly the same way. If, for example, Dworkin supports affirmative action programs where we say certain minorities who've been badly treated in the past, so we think that they should get some sort of compensation for this, so we have policies that favor them. So if you have an affirmative action policy, you're not treating people equally. You're saying people who are benefiting from the affirmative action getting a better deal than those who aren't. But Dworkin thinks that's consistent with equal respect. Whether he's right or not is not something I'm going to go into here, but I just want to bring out this point to illustrate that for him, equal respect is not the same as exactly equal treatment. So what we want is equal respect for people. Now, remember, Nagel said what Nagel places certain value on equality, but he says, well, this is just one of different, all sorts of other values that we have. Liberty, we have to consider rights, and we have to consider overall good consequences. So Nagel thinks there's different values that have to be balanced against each other. Now, Dworkin doesn't think this. Dworkin thinks that equality is its dominant or supreme value. Tyler finds that it's a sovereign virtue. Equality is the overriding virtue. And how does he say that? How does he justify that? Doesn't it seem like, even if you think equality is important, what about liberty? Dworkin's view, you're free only if you don't violate someone else's rights. So supposing, as we would want in libertarian society, say, you're prevented from assaulting others. Of course, in an anarchist society, you wouldn't have a government. But supposing you're not allowed, according to the law, you can't assault others. So in Dworkin's view, this isn't interfering with your liberty, because your liberty is only the freedom to do what doesn't violate people's rights, and you're not free to assault people, so laws against assault don't interfere with your liberty. And similarly, if the government taxes your income to promote equality, it isn't making you less free. And can you see why Dworkin thinks it wouldn't make you less free if the government is taxing your income to promote equality? But this is a hard one because we have to think very much outside the libertarian box to get this. Why would Dworkin say, suppose you say, well, government's taxing me, so isn't it taking away my freedom? Why would Dworkin say no? Does anybody have a suggestion? Well, remember, you're free only if you're not violating other people's rights, and when the government is taxing your income, you don't have a right to that income if it's promoting equality in the way Dworkin thinks is the correct way to do it. So it's not interfering with your right. Now, I must say, of course, I don't agree with Dworkin on equality, but even from its own point of view, it seems an implausible point of view. Supposing we imagine a society there's a particular religion that's very dominant, and they say the true values are determined by our religion. So only people, if you're only you don't have the right to say anything against the religion we've established. So I don't think it would be a good argument to say, well, this society isn't, from its own point of view, interfering with people's freedom because it doesn't think people really have a right to criticize their religion. So, but this would be similar to the way Dworkin is arguing. He's saying, well, you only have freedom in the way if you're exercising your freedom of action in the morally proper way. This seems wrong. I mean, even if you're doing the wrong thing and you have a law to stop you, it's still a restriction of your liberty. But in any event, Dworkin thinks would not accept the notion of conflict between liberty and equality. So all we have, it was a book, a very good book by the Austrian historian, writer, Eric von Kuhnau-Wien, who I met several times, called Liberty or Equality. Dworkin would not accept that antithesis. Now, there's a surprisingly libertarian aspect of Dworkin's theory. He has this moralized view of freedom that we would find very hard to accept. But nevertheless, there is an aspect of his theory that's very libertarian. He thinks that people are responsible for their own lives. So if you make bad choices, say you're an alcoholic and just find yourself out in the gutter, you can't demand that others bear the cost of these choices. People have to take responsibility for their own lives. And in order for people to lead responsible lives, a free market is essential. So this sounds like he's taken the Ayn Rand objectivism course. He's saying we have, each person is responsible for his own life, and we need to have a free market. So you might say, well, if you think that, I should say also, there's another argument, just before I get to this point about continuing libertarian, there's another argument that he gives that I think libertarians will find useful. He criticizes Rawls's argument for a theory of justice. Remember, Rawls said, and we talked about this the last time, that the principles of justice are those that would be chosen by self-interested actors in the original position where people are behind the veil of ignorance. Remember, in Rawls's theory, people don't know what their own talents and abilities are, they don't know their own conceptions of good, but they try to choose what would be to their own interest in this kind of restricted knowledge that Rawls called the veil of ignorance. And they come up with the difference principle on this basis. So Dworkin asks, well, supposing it's right that self-interested choosers would say the difference principle in the original position, why should we care about that? Why should we think that choice in the original position has anything to do with justice? Why is self-interested choice in this kind of in a situation where you don't know anything, what does that have to do with justice? What's supposed to be the reason for thinking what people decide there is the gives you the proper principle of justice? I think it's a very interesting, important objection to Rawls. But what, to return to the point we made on Dworkin's own theory, if he favors the free market and personal responsibility, then why isn't he a libertarian? He's definitely not one. Well, he thinks, and this is the libertarian part, that people who choose in a way that works out badly should bear the cost of their own choices. So supposing you're just, you gamble away all your money, that's your problem. You can't come to the state and say, well, I just wasted all the money, so I want other people should have to support me. But, so he calls this option luck. This is luck based on your own choices that you gambled and you lost. So he doesn't think that people responsible for exercising their own options and other people can't come to other people and demand that other people take care of them. However, people are not responsible for what he calls brute luck. And this includes how their talents are valued. What he means by that is he's not so much stressing that people have Charles, I'll get to your question, so it's a very good question, but people are not so much he's stressing that people are born with different sets of abilities, but what he's stressing is that it's a matter of luck, brute luck, how your talents are valued. To give an example we've given in the previous lecture, say, imagine Kobe Bryant is extraordinarily good at basketball. And what Dworkin considers the brute luck here is it happens to be the case that in American society, a lot of people like basketball. They want to see basketball games. So he's able to get enormous amounts of money for that. Say, if you imagine people who are very talented in other ways, like I mentioned before, say somebody's one of the greatest checker player, the greatest checker player of all time, Marion Tinsley, was a math professor at Ohio State. He didn't get much money for his tremendous ability because people aren't all that interested in spending money on watching checker matches, even though, despite how talented he was. So how your talents their value by the market is something that's a matter of group life. And also, what your health is also a matter of group life. Now, Charles points out, it's a very good point, that to some extent, how healthy you are depends on how you take care of yourself. And George would consider that option life. But what he has in mind when he talks about health and group life is the fact that some people are born, say, with birth defects or develop extremely serious illnesses that don't come about because of the way they live their lives. They just got these conditions. So he thinks that this is really how healthy you are, this part of how healthy you are, is a matter of group luck, not option luck. So he proposes to correct for group luck by imagining an artificial margin. So in this artificial margin, each person is starting with equal resources. And then, so each person has sort of equal resources. And then you're participating in two auctions. In the first of these auctions, each person knows his own talents, so you know what abilities you have. But you don't know how the market will value these talents. Say, suppose you know you're extremely, like, say you're Kobe Bryant, you're in this market, you know you're extremely gifted in basketball, though, but you don't know how people are going to value basketball abilities. Maybe they won't value it at all. So you would buy insurance depending on, again, you're coming up with a bad outcome. You would, Jordan thinks you would buy insurance to make sure that you didn't end up where people just didn't value your talents. And in the second of these markets, people don't know the state of their health. And so they buy insurance against having debilitating illnesses or disabilities. Now, one problem with this idea is it's very difficult to imagine what amount of insurance would be chosen. For instance, well, people would insure against being in a situation where the market doesn't value your talents, and they also insure against getting illnesses, but how they know what amount of insurance to pick. And on the view of probability that von Mises had, such estimates aren't possible, because what Mises held, and I gave a course on Mises' epistemology, but we went into more detail, but basic thing is Mises thinks you can't get individual probabilities for this sort of thing. You would only be able to apply calculated probability for a whole class of events, not for individual outcomes. So if Mises is right, it usually is, you wouldn't be able to come up with the amounts of insurance in the market at all. And based on the way the government estimates the result, what would be the results of these insurance markets, the government would make payments to those whose talents aren't highly sought after, to those with illnesses and disabilities. So the government is trying to estimate what insurance would people have chosen in this artificial market, and then it would make a redistribution on that basis. And then once people get these payments, then they're on their own. So then we have the free market operating. And Schott points out that Hopper's lecture on health insurance said, he mentions the point that you can't really do these probability calculations. So that, basically, I went over a few minutes because I started late, so that's basically Nagel and Dworkin. These are two, I'm sure that most of you wouldn't agree with them, but they're two extremely influential theorists, so I think people should be familiar with them if you want to understand contemporary world and political philosophy. Okay, so I think in the time left, we'll have questions, or people can make fun of Nagel and Dworkin, they can make fun of me or anything you like. Now, Jacques says, he just found their contortionists. Well, that's an interesting twist on things, isn't it? And how do you think they are contortionists? You say every atom has a problem, they make another rule to get around it. Well, I mean, they do try to deal with objections to their own theory, I think, in that sense, they're all right. And I think there is a sense in which they know the outcome in advance, namely some sort of egalitarian redistribution, and so they're kind of fixing things so it'll come out that way. So I think that in that sense, it would good point in making. Wait, here's another longer question. Matthew said, isn't work between group not so much because how can you ever determine whether an alcoholic made bad choices in his options? You're quite right. There's an excellent point in making that it would be very hard in practice to determine for particular people. You give the example of an alcoholic, how would you know when he's made bad choices among his options? Or maybe he's just born in a certain way that predisposed him to alcoholism. Well, there, I think you're right, you couldn't tell, but I think what Dworkin would think is you just make best estimates you can for alcoholics in general of what is, which part is proof luck and which part is option luck. He would correct only for what you thought was proof luck. And as I say, I think in terms of insurance matters, I don't think he could come up with non-arbitrary ways of settling these matters, but that would be what he'd be trying to do. He'd be trying to figure out, he'd say, well, to some extent, these conditions are due to brute luck, and we just have to come up with some best estimate we can what that is. Let's see, here's another point. And first one, Jacques says, yes, I think that's a very good point. We shouldn't think that, looking at the history of government, we shouldn't think they're going to do a very good job of getting a just system distribution. Even if you thought there was something to these theories, they're not going to be able to do it in a way that would respect people's autonomy, or it would be any, they would just, be a nightmare if they were living in such a society. Now, Charles is saying, if there was a world sovereign, wouldn't the difference principle apply to everybody in the world? And when it might be part of the motivation for those on the left or the world's government. Well, Nagel's view on this, I think you're right, is under those conditions, if everybody in the world formed part of one society, then you would have these egalitarian obligations to everybody. But he doesn't think that's likely to be the case. He thinks as the world is today, people have these societies who are just bound to each other in nations, and he sees no in particular reason to move toward this more world system. He's not particularly in favor of the government, although he does have a footnote that refers to some work of Joshua Cohen that maybe there's some international institutions that do have some kind of governmental role, but he's not particularly a world government person of internationals. He doesn't. He's pretty much content with the system where, say, those of us in the U.S. just have to worry about people in the U.S. We might have some moral duties to relieve people badly off in other countries, but they wouldn't be obligations of justice. Maybe just a certain kind of, we should give a certain amount of foreign aid, but we don't have to give the same amount. We don't have to treat people in a different community that they were part of their own communities. He seems perfectly content with that. Okay. Let's see, there's another one. John says he would be left with a bit of red face and straight over. Is that the trigger for call? Well, remember, he's not thinking there is that global injustice. I think if it turned out there was sort of everybody in the world, most people wanted libertarianism, I think he would just say, well, they should recognize that people are just making the wrong choice in his view. Now, wait, we have another question. Okay, here's one. Amar Orlowski, why does NATO assume people? Where does this general will come from? Well, the way Nagel's considering is that sort of we're constituting the society together. We're all kind of making promises to each other. We're all bound together. So he thinks where the general will comes from is just kind of from an agreement, not necessarily an explicit agreement, that people were in the society were kind of agreeing to take account of the views of other people's side, were kind of contracting with others to be in the same society, so we were obligated to those people. The general will comes in just kind of constituting the society. That's basically what he thinks. Of course, he might not find that a very plausible view, but he thinks that, say, when we're in the, say, those of us in the U.S. have in some sense agreed to be part of the same society as other people, we're forming a nation, so that we're bound to other people in the nation that we've entered into these agreements. Of course, you know, in ways that kind of Lysander Spooner, but who has made such an agreement, but I think Nagel would kind of would just think that just by being in the nation state, we're forming such community. He thinks it's desirable that we enter into these relations with other people, agreeing to govern ourselves together. He thinks this is something of great moral value. Yes, Jacques, you mentioned Spooner also. Yes, we're thinking along similar lines. Yes, I see we have a lot of Spooner ideas. Now, Leslie says, how would May or Jordan answer if the state is not distributed? It's interesting the way it distributes privilege. Well, I think he wouldn't deny that in fact the people. Government, people in government have their act in a self-interested way. I mean, wouldn't say, wouldn't be committed to saying what public choice you're saying, what the chair would say about the government is in fact wrong. But he would just say if they act in a way that secures their own interests, they're just acting unjustly. What they should be doing is distributing income and privileges in the way in accord with justice. That we would just say, well, we might have to take account when we're trying to figure out what to do in practice for problems that self-interested government actors would generate. But if we talk about what is the just thing to do, then we would just go according to what this theory says. So if they're not disinterested, they should be. Okay, here's one. Oh, that was the same bit, and I'm missing the other ones here. Let me see. Sort of government is necessary. What size do we envisage they would be? I don't think either Nagel or Rawls, I mean Nagel or Dworkin, has really said much. I get the impression they pretty much would be kind of conventional liberals in the American sense, so they probably think something like what we have now in the U.S. is all right. They'd be kind of liberal Democrats. So they would be a pretty extensive state. Well, I'll tell you, I'll give you another story about Nagel. I don't know if I gave this one before, it's kind of a funny story. There's a Perth philosopher named Brian Leiter who runs a very influential website, and he's influential because he has a ratings service of different philosophy departments, and a lot of people pay attention to it. So he attacked Nagel because Nagel had recommended a book favoring the intelligent design movement. Nagel himself is a supporter of that theory, but he thought this was a pretty good book and recommended it. So Leiter was really attacking Nagel and saying Nagel was really terrible. They're saying that. So Nagel wrote to me, I wondered what he thought of it, so he said, I regard Brian Leiter as a joke, but maybe if I didn't have tenure, I wouldn't think that. Now, you wouldn't get this impression, maybe, from what I read at the election. I think he's weak on equality and political philosophy. He really is an extremely good philosopher. He's a very deep thinker. So if you read his other stuff on metaphysics, theory of knowledge, he's very much worth reading. I think very highly of him, I must say. Now, while we're on something, Joe, if you take a look at a picture of Dworkin, I never met Dworkin, if you look at the picture, well, I've heard him lectured, I never met him, but some of his pictures look like he's just peeling a lemon. Looks like he's almost crying. He has his face kind of twisted up in anger. Maybe this is just kind of, I don't know whether that was brood or option luck, but looks rather strange in some of it. He always has that picture of himself and his books that make him look like just peeling them. Now we have a question on Hayek's second book. Well, he has an interesting view, Hayek, on justice. But Hayek suggests the notion of social justice is one that really doesn't make sense in a free market, because he says when we're talking about social justice, we're implying, we're really presupposing that there's sort of an amount of resources or goods that has to be kind of taken collectively, that has to be meted out to people. So just say in Rawls's system, we're saying, well, how is wealth and income to be distributed among the people. So this presupposes that we have all the wealth together, we're going to dole it out to people. In a free market, there isn't any particular group or body distributing money, just people have resources just based on how the market works. There's no centralized authority. So Hayek says, well, really the notion of social distributive justice doesn't apply to the market because we don't even have the question how should things be distributed on the market. There's no central rule. And I think it's a good point. I suppose now critics of Hayek can say, well, if the market doesn't have that feature, that just shows what's wrong with the market. We should get rid of the market. Put in this society where we do have a notion of justice. But then I think Hayek could get back at that person, just show what was wrong with this kind of centralized society. Maybe we have a feature imposition of values on everybody. somebody else. In many cases, even though from both these are trying, it wouldn't work out. So I think what Hayek could say, I think in the 22nd volume, is that in the only workable social system, namely the free market, the whole notion of distributive social justice really doesn't have any application, because that notion supposedly sort of a central body assigning what property shares people should have. Okay, we have a few more minutes. Let's see. Mark, so that was a good book. Yes, I remember, you know, when I took Hayek, the Philosophy of Social Science, he was working on the 3 volumes of Law, Legislation, and Liberty at that time. And Leslie said, did Hayek ever discuss Rawls? Yes, he did. When he first read Rawls, he was very impressed because he thought that what he thought was Rawls is stressing the view that what we're trying to do in a theory of justice is not assign distribution to particular people, but just to give general rules for how the society operates. And this, of course, fits in with what Hayek thought in Constitution of Liberty, where the whole point is the rule of law is we're having general rules that apply to everyone. They don't discriminate against particular people. So when he first read Rawls, he thought, oh, Rawls is really supporting kind of thing he favored. Then he later thought, well, Rawls doesn't really understand his own insight in something through redistribution. He thought the great insight in Rawls is the notion of establishing the structure of society based on general rules, but he didn't like the particular detail that Rawls came up with. I think he has in Law, Legislation, and Liberty has some discussion in Rawls where he mentioned that might be in the 2nd volume. I have to check that. Yes, Charles says, Ayn Rand discussed Rawls very critical. Yes, I mean, she thought that Rawls is simply kind of a Kantian and altruist, so someone. What she was particularly opposed to, I think, was this notion where she thought that Rawls is just taking people's abilities as if they're collective assets to be redistributed to people, so you only get to benefit from your superior ability if it's an advantage of the least well-off group. So she said, well, isn't that really collectivizing people, saying people have to work for the common good or for other people? And this is a typically altruistic theory in her view. It's denying her view that each person is the aim of each person is his or her own flourishing as a rational being. So she would, Rawls' in view would be very much against the way she looked at things. Oh, here's a different. Yes, now Jacques points out sometimes people benefit because of previous existing status action. Yes, that's a very good point. I mean, that would certainly have to be considered. I mean, I think what Dworkin and Nagel and Rawls would do would be just consider, they would just take account of just abilities. They would just be concerned with superior talents not generated from government privileges. They would just be considered, like, well, people benefiting from certain talents because the market favors people with those talents, and they think that's really a matter of luck. I hear something else. Yes, I mean, it could be that even basketball players could benefit by media in certain ways. I mean, it's hard to say how, once you have a government interfere with a thing, where it's hard to say what the effects of that are on particular people on the base. Scott suggests we have to do away with the stakes, see what problems it may. Well, that's an interesting suggestion. I mean, maybe you would have to at least think away what the, how the state is interfering, and maybe you couldn't do that while there is an actual state. That's a very interesting point. You were able to say, well, I'm in favor of that. Sounds like a good idea. Well, let's see. We still have a few more minutes and we have started a bit late. Well, someone says, are you taking Bob Murphy's course? Which course is that? Okay, well, thank you, Emar. I'm glad you liked the lecture. Well, Mankind Mistake Part 1, Part 2, well, that should be a very good course. You wrote the guidebook to Mankind Mistake. All right, does anyone have anything else? Okay, bye everybody. Anyone, anything you'd like me to try to ask Nagel? He has an email. Okay, well, thanks a lot, everybody. So I hope we'll see you next week. Bye, everybody.